Greetings. Welcome to Confessing the Blues. I'm your host, Jim Ange Anderson. On today's show, we feature singer, songwriter, guitarist, and Grammy Award nominee, Dave Rudolph. Also, special guest, keyboardist, John Chorney. Let's roll! Dave Rudolph and John Chorney, welcome to the Farmhouse Studios.
Glad to be here.
Okay. So, Dave, you got a brand new record out. Can you talk about the record?
Do I have to? Well. Yeah, this is an album of mine called Pale Soul. It's my 34th album. I believe in quantity over quality. So we put a lot of them out. But this one is an R&B record, and I kind of trace the history of R&B. Not tracing the history, but I mean, I've kind of tried to write stuff that fit into the history of R&B, I guess you would say. So going back to it, there's an acoustic blues one, and there's a kind of a swing song on there. There is some soul stuff with real horns and some blues, both an acoustic blues and a regular blues. And even a kind of a funky one too on there, like a little funk, like a little bit of a Parliament funk and stuff. So I've always loved that kind of music. So I tried to write stuff and record stuff that would evoke that era, those eras. Yeah.
And you produce this yourself?
Yeah, I usually do produce my own albums. I have got really great players from the city, including John. John's played on there.
Okay.
John did a great keyboard work on that stuff. But, you know, I have like Jim Wodlowski, who's like in, right now he's doing Hamilton, and Felton Offord, who's in Hamilton too. He's played guitar in there, and Wally Huston played bass on that, and he used to tour with Dave Mason, and he's a great session player. So there are just a lot of really great players that sing, and singers too. A lady from Indiana here too sang on that, Marsha Lynn Smith, who's an unbelievably good singer. So,
okay. And can you talk about some of the songs specifically?
Sure. It starts out with kind of I would say an R&B song, wouldn't you, John?
Yeah.
I got a thing. That one is kind of with the real horns and stuff. We were trying to get that kind of Sam and Dave kind of feel, Aretha feel, of with the backbeat drums and stuff. Feel like a king around.
nobody but a muzzle. The way you look at such a victim's crime. Girl, lock me up, I'm glad to do the time. I got a thing, oh, you baby. Feel like a king around you, darling. I got a thing, oh, you baby. Feel like a king.
Pale Soul is the second tune on there. And then Throw Me a Lifeline is more of the doo-wop kind of era, if you remember that. The mm-hmm. shoo-shoo-shoo-wop. Yeah, when I wrote that in Glide, I was thinking of the old line dances on, like, you know, like on Soul Train
okay.
or any of that stuff. So those were kind of in the mind there. So we're kind of all over the place on the stylistically, I think.
But it sounds kind of like a musical journey, right?
Yes, exactly. It may not be a journey you want to take, but it's there. Strap yourself in, baby. It's hard for me to stay serious for any length of time, I might point out.
Well, that's good. I mean, you know, you're an entertainer, right?
That's right. Well, some of my stuff's done on Dr. DeBeto, too. I have a couple Christmas parody albums that are played a lot on that, too.
Really?
Yeah. Stuff like The Little Dumber Boy and Oh Come, I Read the Manual. And Do You Fear What I Fear? Drunken Hunter Shooting Down Reindeer.
I like it.
Yeah, there's something wrong with me. But anyway, yeah, so we have those kinds. Yeah.
So continue on this musical journey.
Oh, yeah. Should I get back on the journey or get back in the car? Well, do you want me to just go right down the
well, not necessarily. What are your some of your favorites or something that really, you know, resonates with you?
You know what I found over the years when I put out albums and stuff like that, and John probably can speak to this too. The song you record and you think, oh, that one's pretty cool and stuff, and then you think, well, maybe people won't like that. That's somebody's favorite song on the album, and then you go, oh, really? I thought this one would be.
Right.
So everybody has their own little influence of what they like. Gator Shack on this one seems to be one that everybody pretty much likes, and it's kind of a really funky song on there, too. It's kind of an amalgam of about three or four different styles. It's got kind of a, I would say, a funk drum pattern on it, but it's almost like a rock bass. And kind of like the Gat Band, if you remember the Gat
sure.
Band, yeah, and stuff like that. So, and then it's got the chick singers in there. And it's got some overtones of B-52. It's a weird amalgam of stuff, but it's kind of a really fun and song, I think.
It gets humid and we're prone to sweat. But bring the heat on, darling, cause we like it wet. We're gonna have us a little soiree. We gotta sell us a case of brews. Spread the word and bring along your dancing shoes. Cause
everybody's talking about the place to go. Everybody's dancing to the audio. Everybody's saying that the place is everybody's at the Gator Shack.
It's a tiny tin shack set back in the Florida swamps. When the music stops to rumble, we begin to stomp. When the gators stick their snout out, when they hear the din and racket, that's when we become proud owners of new gator jackets. Cause
everybody's talking about the place to go. Everybody's dancing to the audio. Everybody's saying that the place is packed. Everybody's at the Gator Shack.
Don't you hear the music? Can't you feel the beat? Can't you feel your heart a-thumping in the stifling heat? Floorboards, they're out of shaking, and the windows crack. Everybody. Everybody's swaying at the Gator Shack, 'cause
everybody's talking about the place to go. Everybody's dancing to the audio. Everybody's saying that the place is packed. Everybody's at the Gator Shack.
It's a place where you can let loose, a perfect place to shake those blues. Everyone forgets their worries when they start to move. When the rhythm hits your eardrums, when your feet move on the road, the music bounces off the rafters rather than the roof.
Everybody's talking about the place to go. Everybody's dancing to the audio. Everybody's saying that the place is packed. Everybody's at the Gator Shack. Everybody's talking about the place to go. Everybody's dancing to the audio. Everybody's singing that the place is back. Everybody's at the Gator Shack.
Hey, 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 hey.
I like Glide because I got to do my Dr. John.
Your Dr.
Leon
John.
Leon Russell piano licks it.
Yeah, that was good. Yeah. And yeah, that's also where that's another Shoop Shoop song, too.
Oh, the background vocals.
Yeah, the Shoop
great,
Shoop. Yeah.
Love the background.
Yeah. And then also, he does a great job of keyboards on Damaged, which is kind of one of the old rockabilly things like
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Jerry Lee Lewis yeah. thing. Yeah. So that was fun, too. He did a great job on that, too.
So, Jen, you're pretty well versed on the keyboard and the piano. I mean, so it sounds like you've got lots of different influences, and you enjoy playing different styles, right?
Yeah, I've pretty well versed. I think I've been doing blues for professional blues musician for probably 25 years,
uh-huh.
And then I got into country. I'm doing some country stuff now, but yeah, I've been pretty well versed in different styles. You know, I can go from Dr. John to Floyd Kramer.
Yeah. that's a big way.
Yeah.
And you started out very young on the piano?
I started classical piano when I was probably 5-6 years old. I studied under a famous Russian concert pianist, Olga Bakero. So I was fortunate to be. Yeah, well,
you will learn the piano.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. She would slam the piano with a pencil. But yeah, she's very strict. But I started off with classical music.
And
yeah.
And how did you were you playing the blues? Did she see you turn the corner and start playing blues? And
No, she only thought that classical music was the main thing. She only cared about classical music.
I'm wondering what her reaction may have been.
Well,
horror.
She's not around now, but right. I didn't really get into blues until I was exposed to blues in college, and I was actually playing guitar then in college.
Uh-huh.
And I started playing blues on guitar, and then after I graduated, some of my college buddies took me to the Kingston Mines. And I just fell in love with the blues. It totally changed my life. I remember seeing, it was Joe Kelly, the Blues Shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Merle Perkins was playing drums. And I always say that Merle changed my life forever. And I don't know if it's for the better or for the worse.
Right.
But I met him. Well, I saw him play with Joe Kelly at the Kingston Mines. I said, well, this is what I really want to do. But I was always a much better keyboard player than I was guitar. So I started learning, you know, taking lessons and going to the Kingston Mines or anywhere there was a blues jam for 2 years. And then every weekend I was down there sitting in or watching people learning and, you know, listening to people like Pinetop Perkins right. and Sonnyland Slim and all those people. I was out like every night. And it took me a couple years. And then eventually I broke in, started getting some gigs. And, yeah, that changed my life was the Kingston Mines. I always joke with my friend Merle. I said, you know, how it changed my life. And, you know, I'll just say this. I when I first met him, I really looked up to him as a musician. I mean, I still do. I still do. But I never dreamed that I would actually be in a band with Merle Perkins. I remember sitting there thinking, we were both playing with Michael Coleman.
Right.
And I'm going, man, I have really made it in the music world. I'm in a band with Merle Perkins, you know. I can't believe it. Dream come true.
That's excellent. But
yeah. Yeah. That's.
And do you think that the classical training prepared you somewhat for the blues? I'm sure it gave you some fundamental skills. And.
It took me a while to... Because with the classical, you had to play it. You could put your own feel to it, play with a feeling, but it had to be very strict, what was written on the page.
Right.
And that was totally different than blues. So it took me, actually, I was a little bit better at first on the guitar because I was self-taught, and I taught myself by ear for guitar. But it took me a little while to get over that with the piano because of the classical training. However, because of the technique and the technical stuff involved with the... with the classical music, it gave me an advantage,
right.
I felt, over a lot of other keyboard players because of the technique I could use. So,
I know early on when I did some of my early albums, I had some classically trained keyboardists and guitar players in there, and they were used to having sheet music in front of them. And so I'd say, well, just riff in this section here, and they would go, and they were completely lost.
Sure.
Not all classic players are like that, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But they have a tendency to read what's in front of them and not have the feel for the music that you need to really do to get a soulful or whatever, something that fits that music. They have to put themselves in the mood of that piece. And also, especially with keyboard players, if you're doing not just straight piano or organ, if you're doing like a part, like say you're doing a Kyoto or something like that, you have to kind of know what that instrument will, where that instrument would go normally. So that's another little part of it, too, when you're recording and stuff. So it's always been interesting to me.
Well, there's the old joke, how do you get a guitar player to stop playing? Put sheet music in front of them?
That's right. Or the old one, how many folk singers does it take to change a light bulb? 9. 8 to 1 to change it and 8 to reminisce about how good the old one was.
That's good. Back to your record.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what you know? You've sort of said it's a journey in you, so you maybe had a theme when you started out. I mean, can you talk about the songwriting process?
Well, I've been writing for a long time, and I write a lot of genres. I mean, I have kids' albums out, so if you're looking me up on iTunes, you'll be, huh?
Right.
Huh? I've also got a bunch of, I've got several different beach kind of influence stuff with soca and reggae and you know, and that, those different kinds of forms of Caribbean music and stuff. But I like to explore different styles, and I don't like to be painted into one corner of writing. Also folk stuff and things of that nature too. So for this one, what you need to do is I'll tell any writer, writing is a muscle, just like anything else. If you keep practicing it, and you're going to write a lot of bad stuff before you write anything good. I mean, that's just the way it is. So what you have to be is disciplined. So you have to figure out a plan, and then once you get there. So you immerse yourself. In this case, I had to immerse myself, and I've always loved this kind of music anyway. So I was kind of steeped in the tradition of this stuff, but I did some research. I tend to research on subjects if I'm doing something that's like this project. And so, you know, I would go back and listen to some old Robert Johnson stuff. I would watch a couple documentary on the field recordings of all of that stuff when they went out there, and the record companies actually paid people to go out and record them in their environments.
Right.
So they would track these people down, and they didn't even know if they were still alive, which is really fascinating to me. And they did the same way with the country stuff, like the Carter family
right.
and things too. So you have that, and then you kind of look at the stuff, and I go to different museums and kind of look at the way rock and roll and R&B intersected and blues intersected with that. There's a great exhibit in, if you go to a Cleveland, if the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, that is an awesome museum, by the way. It's in Cleveland, but that's okay. they have an exhibit where it shows all the influences of all the different bands, and then you can listen to the music of those old people, say, of the people that influence, say, the Beatles, you know, like Little Richard or the Everly Brothers with the harmony stuff, or, you know, almost all of the early British invasion bands were hugely influenced by the American blues.
Sure.
You know, B.B. King and all that stuff. So, you know, if you do your research and then you kind of put it together, and I try to take it in two different things. There's the music first of, you know, in the style, a la the style, and that includes your beats and how you write the song. And then there's lyrics. And then I write the music to kind of fit the lyrics to kind of fit the mood of that song. Yeah, so that's how I kind of go about it.
And do you write on the guitar, piano, or?
Guitar.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm a guitar player.
Okay.
I'm not a lead guitar player. I know my limits. They are vast. But, yeah, so.
And so then what about the recording process? How did you go about recording this record?
Well, I tend to operate a little different than a lot of people do. A lot of people put everybody in the room at the same time. I don't kind of operate this. I'm a solo act primarily, and then sometimes I'll have band and have John and the other things. So I'll find a pattern and stuff that I really like and then build the song around the pattern. Then we bring in and construct it piece by piece. Sometimes they can give you, if you're not careful, it can end up being very sterile recording that way. But if you have really gifted players, and I mean, I've been really fortunate to have gifted players, I mean, top-notch players, they compensate for that. So we kind of build the track that way, and then piece by piece. And then I decide, you know, I need horns here, I need that. So that's a producing hat rather than a writing hat. So.
And I think John mentioned the horns on this record was Aretha's horn section.
Well, the horn section that they use when she comes into town.
Okay.
Aretha travels on a bus, you know. She won't.
Right, she doesn't fly.
No, she won't fly. She just canceled the December gate because it was roads are bad and stuff. But so she'll hire horn sections in the town. Well, these guys play on everything.
Yeah.
They're really good. Yeah, so Larry Brown and some of the other guys, too. Yeah. Larry, unfortunately, just passed away not too long ago. So,
so you mentioned this is your 34th album.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
So, can you talk about some of the other projects? You said you have the beach stuff and some children's stuff, and
yeah, I've got 13 kids albums. I used to write for Disney, and I've got some gold records and Grammys for that stuff. At one point, interesting, I have a weird career. At one point, I did the TV pilot for the all-new Captain Kangaroo show. I was supposed to be the new Captain Kangaroo.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They flew me out to L.A. and everything else. And that's a long story we won't get into. It's typical Hollywood, though, with Saban and do the Power Rangers and stuff. But so I wrote those. I've got some kind of more acoustic versions. When I try to challenge myself and write different stuff. And the beach stuff is, I've always loved that stuff because the rhythms
sure.
in that stuff is so interesting. You know, from reggae to calypso and all that stuff. And each of them has their own little niche, and it's kind of fun. So, and those come out of ska, actually. You know, reggae was kind of a ska, is an evolution of ska. So I have those, and I have some straight-ahead kind of rock albums, and I have a lot of singer-songwriter albums. That the other album I put out to this time, I did two. I did two last year and two this year, because that's me.
Two at the same time.
Two at the same time.
Right. Dave had me coming over. One day it's the blues R&B album, and then it's the, I don't know, how would you describe the second one?
It's a singer-songwriter. It's all, yeah, it's got a wide range of genres. And so John, I go, okay, let's, on his keyboard, I'm going, okay, let's find a hammered dulcimer sound. He goes, what?
Like, what is that?
and then half the time I go, oh, play this. And he goes, what? So I was taxing John. I hope he didn't hate me after that album.
No, it was a challenge. I wasn't used to, because we're primarily doing blues and R&B and some rock in the country. I wasn't used to all those weird sounds you were having me play or whatever. But it was
textures.
It was very textures. It was very challenging. I'd have to go home and work on it.
Yeah.
You know, so but it was good. Yeah. Two Dave's very prolific, you know.
Yeah.
How many songs do you think you've written over the years?
I don't know. Hundreds.
Sure.
I don't keep track of them. I mean, in the sense of how many. I don't tend to use that as a litmus. Because a couple of them, a bunch of them are double albums and stuff.
Wow.
And I'll try different things. Like a couple years ago, we did an acoustic live album. We recorded it live while we recorded in the studio. We did 21 songs in 7 hours. It was, and it got great reviews, which is great. And then the other half of the other CD was stuff I did live. So, you know, you have to kind of push yourself as a writer or as a performer or as a singer. Otherwise, you do the same thing over and over again, and I really don't like that.
But it sounds like you've accomplished that, you're very prolific, but you're not, I mean, so many people keep on putting the same record out every time, you know.
Well, I was heavily influenced by bands that didn't do that early in my career. You know, the Beatles, people don't realize now, they grow up now, realize how influential they were in the general pop music. The first band that pretty much primarily wrote their own material. A lot of recording techniques were done first on the Beatles, the first feedback on a record. Thunder drums, that was the first thunder drums. There was all kinds of stuff if you read about it.
The reverse tape.
Right, reverse tape. And, you know, Sgt.
Pepper. The sitar.
Sgt. Pepper's was recorded on a four-track machine.
It's unbelievable.
I know, and it sonically, it sounds awesome even today. And that just shows how incredible they were. And I mean, you know, I know some blues people are not really into the Beatles, although they could be a good rockin' blues band, actually. Their whole thing started out in Hamburg, and they used to do a lot of the Little Richard and the
just
blues
the old
bands.
R&B stuff.
Yeah, they did. They were huge on that stuff. In fact, a bunch of their songs on the first albums were that. But you know, bands like that who constantly evolved were the bands I love the most, and that's why I kind of model myself as a writer. You know, and I'll probably do another one of these R&B albums. We had so much fun, and it's getting great reviews, which is awesome. So.
Didn't you say that some people think that's your best?
Some people
work?
Do. Some people do, which is great. I love that too. Everybody has their own little favorites of what they do, which is great. I like that a lot too.
So, can you talk about how you got started in music?
After college, I had a band real briefly. It was acoustic kind of harmony band, almost like an America kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I graduated in '72. I'm old. But I still have my teeth, so that's good. Not much else. Not my hair. I don't have my hair anymore. Dang it. In fact, out of one of my last albums, I had a song called You're Getting Old, and it's all old jokes.
How funny.
Yeah, it's like when a Boy Scout tries to help you cross the street. When you getting lucky means finding your lost keys. It's all those kind of lines. Right. You can grow hair on your rear and your nose and in your ears, but on your head it's disappeared. Let's face it, you're old. So I lost track of the question. Yeah. I see that's another sign of getting old.
We're talking about how you got started after college.
Thank you. Yeah. Good thing you're here. Kind of derived this car because this guy can't drive anymore. I started out and then I went on my, I did a solo. I did solo for a long time. And I was doing a lot of the clubs in the city, Chicago, Earl of Old Town, and those kind of places. And Orphans, if anybody remembers Orphans.
Right.
Yeah, I played Orphans and Somebody Else's Troubles. But I realized early on you can't make any money in the city. So I started doing the college tours. And I looked around the college tours, and I saw all these good-looking young guys getting hired for, singer-songwriter stuff. And I go, well, I ain't going to be me. I ain't that good-looking. So I was a goofball. So I wrote all this humor tunes and stuff like that. And I kind of evaluated the market and went after that and did that stuff. And built my studio, started recording the serious stuff on the side. And then I had kids and started doing some kids stuff and writing for Disney and doing a bunch of different projects for that, too. So it's kind of a long evolution, winding. It's a winding road. So,
can you talk about your experience with Disney?
Yeah, it's Disney's interesting. You worked with Disney too, didn't you?
Just a couple of gigs, really, but yes.
Yeah. Well, as a writer, at one point I was supposed to sign with them as an artist, with a kids artist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they had Norman Foote and a bunch of other people on their roster. And then somewhere along the line, they go, it's easier to sell Mickey Mouse singing a song. So they let everybody on their roster go. They let all of the people that they had on their roster. But they kept me on to do writing for them. And so they would send, it's interesting because they would send you stuff. They would send you a two-paragraph description of a movie like George of the Jungle. And you had to write songs for that and submit them on spec.
Wow. Well, that's a challenge, yeah.
Oh, it was a big challenge. Yeah. And so I wrote for a bunch of the movies, and I always made it to the final cut, and then the producer would go, I want to put one of my songs on here.
Of course, yeah.
Because you make money on that. But then I wrote for an album for Winnie the Pooh. They had me write a bunch of songs for Winnie the Pooh, songs from 100 Acre Woods, and I got a couple songs on that, and that made me some good money and stuff like that. So that was when I wrote for them. But it's weird. None of the departments in Disney talk to the other departments. So the movie people don't talk to the TV people and that stuff. And so they're very compartmentalized. And it's very much like, the sky is falling. They'll decide, everybody decides we're going to do this. Like one time they told me, okay, we're going to do an album of friendship songs and we want them to be in Irish mode. And I go, okay. So I wrote a couple of the songs. I go, and then I send them out to, I produce them and send them out, and they go, we've changed our mind. I'm going, oh, great, thanks. I just spent that money for nothing.
Right.
You just end up repurposing your songs for something else.
Sure. You're a funny guy. A lot of your songs have humor in them. And I don't think that was necessarily a marketing idea. It's just that naturally you're have a good sense of humor.
Well, some people would argue with that. Right. He's not funny. Well, I always add the humor and stuff. And even on this one, on the new album, there's a song called I'm Tired. And it's a blues tune. And it's just about, I used to party all night long, but now I need a nap. So, okay. So I always try to add a little bit of levity in the stuff. So, and that's always. And then I have whole albums of just funny tunes, uh-huh. too. So. It's another form of writing, by the way. It's a different kind of writing. And there's separate writings within the form of that. Like a parody is a different form of writing than writing a song of its whole, from the cloth, whole cloth. Because then the song is funny and it has to be integrally funny with inside the song itself. A parody, what you're trying to do is make it similar to the original, but changing words here and there.
Like the Little Dumber Boy?
Yes, the Little Dumber Boy. Or Do You Fear What I Fear? Drunken Hunter Shooting Down Reindeer. Do you see? Yeah, we got a bunch of them. We do. And then I took on the other flip side of that, I have the second parody Christmas one is called Bubba Christmas. And that lent a little bit more towards country. So we did a parody of Johnny Cash's song, The Ring of Fire, called The Flu of Fire. Santa fell into a burning flue of fire. And we did, I've Got Friends in Low Places, mm-hmm. Garth Brooks. I did I Strung Lights in High Places. But I was drunk and kind of wasted. Now they're all falling down. Why? I'm talking about a lot of drinking right now, don't I? What the heck?
It's a challenge working for Dave because you never know. You've got to learn all this material. The first show I did with him, he sent me a list of about 60 songs. And it's anything from Jimi Hendrix to Jimmy Buffett to his original stuff. I'm like, Dave, could you please narrow this down a little bit? Because you've got all the different shows. Like one show, it might be a Christmas show. Then it's a Halloween show. Now it's kids' beach party. Now it's adult beach party. Now we've got the British invasion show.
Yeah.
And then you have to learn the new material on top of it. So it's a challenge keeping up with it.
I am a taskmaster, I'll tell you. Well, I never know what I'm going to do from time to time.
Just like the British Invasion show we did. You sent me a list. I didn't even count how many songs. I had to be at least 50 or 60 songs.
Yeah, but I told you to pay attention to the first 20.
Well, just look at the first 20 or so. That's what you go, or so. And then you sent me another thing. Well, check out this song. I'm like, that's not in the first 20 or whatever. So
I'm bad on my band.
Have you ever shown up to a gig like in the, the shorts and the Hawaiian shirt? And I'm like, oh, wait, no, I'm at the British Invasion gig,
Oh, it wouldn't make any difference anyway. Right. Trust me. John will tell you, I vamp on stage and I make fun and I joke with the audience. I do all kinds of stuff. Yeah. And we'll go off into tangents. The audience, like yesterday, we did a British Invasion show yesterday and somebody's going, do some Doors. I go, they're not British Invasion, but okay, we'll do it. And we did it.
Yep.
I don't care. You know, you're not, the thing you got to realize when you're on stage is that you're a performer. You're not, I always hate this artist thing, you know. I could do, we were talking about this before the show started, I have plenty of original material to do. But it depends, depending on the show, if it's an original material show, then I'm going to do original material. But a lot of shows, you know, people are coming to see and hear certain things. And like you would do the standard blues things that people want to hear, and I'll do songs. I don't care. I love the songs. If it's a song I love, I have no problem doing it. I don't have any ego. Jeez, I like to go out and hear some other songs that I like too. So why should I be any different than anybody else, you know?
So whatever the gig calls for.
Whatever the gig calls for. You're in the service of being an entertainer for, you know, whoever's hiring you is paying you to be an entertainer. They're not paying you to be an artiste. And to get crazy about stuff, and believe me, I've had so many weird things happen to me over the years. You just got to let it roll off your back. You're not curing cancer up there. You're a performer, for Christ's sake, and you're lucky to be one. So,
how many shows a year do you think you do?
I used to do maybe 250 or so. That I've cut that down a little bit as I've done. I still do a lot, though. I'll do 200 maybe a year, 175. Yeah, I still do a lot, especially in the summer. A lot of park districts, libraries, festivals and stuff. So
I'm always impressed by someone who's won a Grammy. Can you tell me about that experience?
Well, that was for the Disney stuff.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it is what it is. You know, you go to the Grammy party and stuff like that. We didn't win. We were nominated for Grammy.
Nominated, okay.
I got a gold record. I won a gold record with that and stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of awards that are out there. I'm a 15-time nominee for College Entertainer of the Year awards and various stuff, but that doesn't mean a whole lot. You know what I mean? Kudos don't necessarily transfer into any more money or anything else like that. I mean, it's nice to get some acknowledgement from people and stuff, but, you know, you can't let any of that stuff go to your head anyway, because the easy way to keep your head is to do a college cafeteria during the afternoon. I'll tell you that right now.
Right.
Or some of these jobs where people go, what the hell are you doing up there? You know? So, you know, it's easy to keep my head on straight. I've done plenty of crap gigs.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned earlier that you've also, over the years, done some voiceovers and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I've narrated some CD-ROMs. I've narrated some books, actually, some small books and stuff. None of the stuff that ever made it huge. And I've done some, I have a couple of the kids' albums I have are kind of skit albums, kind of like Fractured Fairy Tale kind of a thing. So we wrote the bit. So one of them is the Not So Grim Fairy Tales. And so we would have which is a different kind of writing too. It was really fun. And so me and Mark McClain is a great voiceover, did most of the voices on there. So, like, one of them is Jack and the Beanstalk. It's done like a World Federation wrestling match between Jack and the Beanstalk. Jack. And then Hansel and Gretel has done like a Judge Judy court thing, and she's going, you in the Lederhosen. I was just walking to the woods. So there's that. And then I have a weird career. I've done all kinds of weird stuff. But it's a challenge, and I like taking on challenges.
Did you do comedy, Dave?
Well, I headlined comedy clubs and music comedy in the 80s just to hone my skills as a comedian, because that's a different challenge, too. People drink, and they're used to having punchline, punchline, punchline. And so I would truncate short songs and do a couple bits in between the thing. So it was a whole different a thing, but I did it as a challenge. You don't make as much money in comedy clubs. I have a lot of friends who are in the comedy field now are just like really good, and so boy, I admire those people who get up there and do that stuff,
because they're just up there with, I mean, you can hide behind your guitar sometimes, they're
correct
up there just with a microphone and
correct. But in a way, though, if you're doing a comedy club, you can't hide behind your guitar. It's almost like a negative in some respects. I mean, you have some advantages, but you have some disadvantages,
right?
because it's like people go, I want to hear a joke. Okay. You know, I don't want to listen to a song and hear the punchline later on.
Yeah.
But it teaches you how to work an audience. Really does. Because a lot of them are drunk. You know, by the thing back in the day, especially in the 80s, those were all smoke filled too, by the way. I did a couple of comedy clubs where they had smoke, and by the third night, I was croaking the show after the next. So yeah, it was an interesting thing to do. So,
and so with your work for all the children's music, mm-hmm. and children's, yeah. songs, how do you wrap your head around sort of writing for children? I mean, do you think of your own kids, or I'm just interested in how you can sort of relate with kids,
Well, for one thing, you don't grow up.
Okay, well, that's a good start.
Yeah. My wife will tell you that. Well, it's also putting yourself in the mind frame, and that's true of any kind of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I did have kids. I started writing them when I had kids. And I always felt that that's another whole subdivision. But like with kids stuff, a lot of the stuff that's written for kids is written for preschoolers. You know, it's like the Barney kind of,
mm-hmm.
and I hate that stuff, you know. Clap your hands, stomp your feet. I mean, it's kind of mindless. And I mean, I understand its use and stuff.
Right.
But I never wrote for that. I wrote for the kids who are about like 7 to about 12, 13 when they're the things.
Sure.
So we had the number one song on kids radio in Chicago was called Aunt Sarah's Got a Booger, and it stuck up on her nose. And I write a lot of humor in this stuff. Danny's diapers, and they're not all gross scatological things.
Right.
I mean, it's just the experience of being a kid. And I tried to put that in there in the songs. But my albums, you will find the kid stuff is very all over the place in genre. Because most of the stuff was written in folky kind of thing. And I think that's limiting their exposure. And I also didn't like the fact that some of the kids stuff that were winning awards where they go classic music for kids. Well, there's no classic music for kids. You can put it any way you want.
Right, right.
The only classic music there is for kids is Peter and the Wolf, which was designed specifically for it. So to rename it classics for kids is just the nomenclature. It's not really written for a child. So I tried to write stuff, and we'd do a Cajun song, I Told You So, and then we would do a rock and roll song, Timmy's Got a Problem, and then we do all kinds of musical styles and have some things in there. And so they would be sophisticated from a musical background. That's how I've always tried to do it.
That's great because you're interested in all different music styles. You're able to introduce that to kids where they maybe wouldn't have heard.
Correct.
A reggae song or a soca song.
Right, yeah, there's a reggae song. I have reggae songs on them. And on one album, We Are One World, it started out as a project for Disney, which I repurposed because they wanted this friendship one. So I wrote two different versions of the song with the same, pretty much the same melody. And then I did one kind of a rockin' thing, and then I did one as a reggae. And so I said in liner notes, I said, this is an example you can show kids of how different rhythms and different instrumentation can make a song sound almost completely different.
Right.
Which I thought was kind of an interesting thing. I'd never seen that done before. I also wrote a Bossa Nova kid song. I don't know that anybody's ever
right.
done that before.
That's fun.
Yeah.
So much writing is done, you know, in a silo all by yourself. Do you bounce some of this music off your wife, your children, or different people to see if it's working, or do you just, you know?
No, I don't do that. They kind of let me do my own thing.
Okay.
Then when we get in the studio, you know, you'll find some things work and some don't work. And there's my hard drives are littered with things that didn't work.
Right,
you know,
right.
You thought that it would, and there'd be a great bit and stuff. And then you go, it's just not going anywhere. And then sometimes you'll come back to something later on. You go, oh, I should have sped the tempo up, or I should have put a minor chord in here. Just
mm-hmm.
some little change, and then it works. So,
right.
I always say, write down everything, man.
Oh, yeah.
Because you never know what's going to come back to you. And that's phrases, too.
Yeah. You go back and sort of borrow from yourself. I've done that where I'm stuck and like, oh, here's this bridge I wrote 15 years ago. This will fit
exactly
in the song.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Or and you might hit it from a different tonally thing. You might just sing it a little different and then it works. You know what I mean? That almost all songwriters will tell you that. Yeah. So.
Do you find inspiration in different places?
Oh, yeah. More and more, I get a little more political in the stuff that I'm writing and stuff, too, because it kind of demands it now. I read a lot of papers. I read a lot. I watch a lot of stuff, and that'll influence you. And you can run across some interesting stories, like on Son of a Beach Party. There's a song called Two Toe Tom. And it's actually something I ran across as an article in right in the bridge where Florida, and it's kind of a really funky swamp song, if you know, like Tony Joe White kind of thing. It's a true legend that's out there from right at the border of Florida and Alabama. It's called Florala. There's a legend about this gator that only had two toes in the back instead of three, and he harassed the people. I mean, he would eat all their livestock and thing, and he supposedly ate this one granddaughter and all this stuff, one of this guy's granddaughter. So I wrote a whole song about it, and that what's interesting is after that they have a Two Toe Tom festival, and they called me and asked me if they could use it as the theme song for the fest, and I thought that was kind of cool.
It's excellent. Yeah. So Dave, I've got a question. I've 250 shows a year for all these years. I'm sure you've done some interesting shows with some interesting bands. I was reading your website, and I saw like Smothers Brothers, Mamas and the Papas. I mean, can you talk about some of those interactions?
Yeah, there's some interesting stories on that stuff. I opened for Cheech and Chong once in a theater in the Round, and it was at Mill Run Theater. And even to this day, theaters will sell season tickets, right? So... And it was a rotating stage.
Sure, I remember that place. Yeah.
So you had a bunch of people in the audience who had no idea who Cheech and Chong were. They just came.
They showed up,
They were like 70, 80-year-old people. And the first thing they do is they get back-to-back and flipped off the audience, go, F you. And all the young people are screaming, and the old people are grabbing their hearts going, Margaret! It was so funny. And then I opened for the Everly Brothers once, and, you know, they hated each other. They couldn't stand each other. And they had two buses, and each one had their own bus. And they came on stage from opposite ends of the stage, didn't say a word to each other in the entire show, and then turned around and went into their buses. They sounded great, though. Alvin Lee was with them and stuff.
Uh-huh.
They were great.
I mean, the Everly Brothers, there was just such a magic with those two voices. And it's amazing that they didn't get along. They could make this beautiful music. And
Well, you know, they were one of the blueprints for a lot of the British invasion.
The Beatles harmonies.
They were heavily influenced on that. You know, there's some people that are really sweet. And, you know, opening, you know, like the Smothers Brothers were really super nice. And they were really funny, too. But, you know, half the time as an opening act, if you've done it before, you know, you don't even meet them.
Sure, or you pass them into
the backstage. Yeah, and then they're in their own little dressing room and stuff. So to make it any more than what it is, you're supposed to do your time and get the audience warmed up and get off the stage. That's really what it is. Some of them were incredibly gracious to me and said, I know some other brothers were talking about doing one of my songs at one time, but they didn't end up doing it. You know, and the Gatlin brothers were really nice. And then the other people, like the Beach Boys, I never even saw them. I mean, you know, I never even had any interaction at all with them and stuff. So, you know, it is what it is. It's cool to be doing them, but... and John, you've opened for some people recently too, haven't you?
Yeah, I still get really excited. It's just my love of music and people I look up to. Like in blues, I'd opened for B.B. King and John Lee Hooker, Robert Cray,
excellent,
Bo Diddley. Let me see, who else? Yeah, a lot of Buddy Guy, and I know I got at first. I was playing with Michael Coleman when I was doing a lot of these gigs. And it meant nothing to him. He wouldn't even tell me. We were in Finland, and we were opening up for doing a major festival with Robert Cray and Bo Diddley and John Lee Hooker. And, like, he didn't even tell me, you know. And then I look on the program, the festival program, I'm like, wow, you know, Robert, we're on the same show with Robert Cray. And then I see him in the hotel. We're eating dinner together and stuff like that. So it was a big thrill to me. But to Mike, it was just another day at
another
the
gig,
job. He didn't care, you know. Or,
what are the plans for the future?
The next album out, I start recording on that, and that's not an original one. This is going to be a British Reinvasion album. So I'm going to redo some British invade, because we're doing this show, but also because I've always loved that music. So that one is the next album, and then there's two other albums after that that I've started writing for. One's kind of a very simple, cut-down acoustic album, more lightly produced, and then I'm going to do, I want to do a rock album that's kind of reminiscent of, if you think about the early rock stuff, it was hook-laden. It was hook-laden in both iconic hooks, like a lead guitar or harmonies, or a chorus that was really thing, you know, like Green Eyed Lady or anything like that. You know, it's just, you hear the first couple notes, you know exactly what that song is. And that's kind of what I'm going to try to strive to do, and to write kind of real hook-laden kind of a thing. So that's another challenge for that. And then we'll see what happens. I got a couple other ideas too. We'll see how they go progress on that.
It doesn't sound like your well has ever run dry.
Not yet, thank God.
Do you ever get a writer's block?
Not particularly. I mean, I'll get stuck on a song for a while, and then I'll leave it alone, and then sometimes I'll just let it go. But you gotta try to succeed. If you know, and if it doesn't, goes there. And then sometimes you'll find things as you're recording, you can change stuff and make it that much better. So far, I haven't had a problem. I mean, we did two albums this year. We did two albums last year. I've pretty much been operating on one or two albums a year for the last almost 20 years. So,
what are your feelings?
I think you've released, is it four within the last year?
Yeah,
Put out like in the
two last year, two this year. Yeah,
within the last year.
Well, no, one was in.
When did All Folked Up come out?
that was like March last year. Yeah, that was an interesting album.
It's been within the last. March or
April. Yeah, it was about a year. That's an interesting album. It's called All Folked Up Volume 3, and it's a mockumentary. You know, it's kind of like Mighty Wind.
Mm-hmm.
So the concept is that it was a hard one to write. The concept was that it supposedly found songs from around the country and around the world. So, and then there's a booklet inside, and it's a fake backstories on all the people who supposedly wrote them. So there's like a Bossa Nova song that's supposed to be the answer to the girl from Ipanema called The Boy from Fargo. And then there is a, let's see what else. Oh, there is a country swing one, which was great because I got to study this stuff. There's a country swing one called Rodeo Clown. It's about his love, baby's in love with a rodeo clown. And there's a protest song that's protesting the protesters on his lawn. So it's a very meta. And it's 60s. It's done like a Dylan thing. And then what else is on there? There's a bunch of other ones. There's a bluegrass one. There's all kinds of stuff. But it was cool because I tried to record them in kind of the genres of what they are, but try to make it sound whole. And a bunch of them are pretty funny. So,
has anyone recorded your songs?
Yeah. Some people have. Not as many as I would like to.
Sure.
And that would be something I would hope for this particular album, actually. The Pale Soul, because you know they probably can reach a lot more people than I could on this thing, and I think the songs are strong, but you know, you never know. It's hard to self-judge yourself, you know what I mean?
Right.
Because you hear certain things in it, and you know, I've learned long ago not to have any ego attached to that, because I write a lot. So yeah, I've had some stuff recorded by some folk artists and stuff, and I've had things played on TV shows and stuff like that of mine too, which is great and stuff. I'd like to get, that's another area I would really love to get into. It's lucrative, is like licensing of my stuff for like movies and commercials and stuff. I get some stuff here and there, but nothing big.
What are your thoughts on the record industry and music industry, the changes that have transpired in the last 20 years?
Well, it's a mixed bag, because when I first started out, I started out in vinyl, and studios were very hard to record in, because a good studio, like my first album it sucks. I mean, it's really bad. It's 73, and it was really a four-track studio, and I didn't know what I was doing because I couldn't afford anything else. But like if you recorded in a good studio, it was really, really expensive. It was really expensive to get vinyl. There was no place to have this stuff distributed. However, on the plus side, that cut down the amount of material that was out there. Nowadays, you can record anything, and it's great that you can do that, and you can put it up on YouTube or the other stuff, but there's a lot more noise that's out there, too. Right. So there's both good things and bad things. The really bad thing, I think, is that corporations have bought up all the radio stations. Like maybe three or four companies own all the radio stations. And back in the day, you had FM radio that would play alternative stuff or your local bands. But now they're really on tight playlists. It's almost impossible to get
to break into. Yeah.
So it's hard to get your stuff out there. And then if you have to hope that people discover you on the internet somehow.
Well, you guys want to make some music?
Sure, let's do
that. Sounds good.
My getaway pay has got up and gone. I stay up too late and I start to yawn. My stamina, it won't take me too far. But for short bursts, I can be a star. Cause I'm tired. Whoa, baby, I'm so tired. Tired.